And so just to let you know, recording has now started also.
Okay.
Hey everybody, this is Sierra. I'm from April. Welcome everybody. We started in about 9 to 10 minutes. So 8 to 9, it just changed. So just hang out. You're here for the Fair Housing Act youth training, hopefully. If not, it'll be good information. In a minute, I'm going to drop in the chat box the pre-survey, if you guys could take, that will help us know kind of what you learned and everything to take away from this and where we can add to it in the future. So just hang out for about 8 more minutes. Thanks for joining. Hey, everybody. Thanks for joining. This is Sierra. I'm from April. We are going to get started in about 5 to 6 minutes with the April's Fair Housing Act Youth Training. I've only done a few Zoom webinars this week, so I got to remember which one I'm on. Hopefully you're at the right place too. We have our panelists. You'll see them hanging out on the screen if you're on the webinar platform. I do encourage everybody to jump on the webinar platform if you can. We're going to have some polls today that you can only participate if you're online for those pieces. There is a pre-survey also in the chat box. I encourage you to get involved, jump over there and do that before we get started. That just helps us continue to get better. So we'll get started in about 4 minutes. Thanks for joining.
Wait. Can't hear.
Hi, Stevie. We're going to get started in a few minutes. I think most people are muted right now.
Okay. Y'all can hear me?
Yes. Yes, we can.
Wow. Okay. This is a new platform. Okay. Because I heard y'all typing a minute ago, and so then it threw me off. Sarah, I can't hear you because I know you're laughing. Unmute yourself.
I am muted. See, I always make sure because I know I type really loud. But I was saying, you're the one that recommended this platform to me.
I know. It's all my fault. Wow. Who else is here? I can only see you three. And you can see me.
Yep. Yeah, so webcams are not turned on as attendees. We can do that maybe later sessions if we want. But everybody else is just by microphone or phone.
Oh, well, how did I do this? I just was hitting buttons.
I opened everybody's ability to speak. So you can unmute yourself, but that way you can jump in the conversation when you want. The only time I'll mute you is if you have that loud background noise, then I'll mute you and take away your ability to talk.
Do you hear any background noise right now?
You're good.
Okay, cool. Can you see me?
I cannot see you, no.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. Oh, hey to the other two. I'm sorry, guys.
Okay. So, hi, this is Sierra again. I'm going to go ahead and get started. Usually I start here, but we got a lot of information to pack into today. So, I want to make sure that we have the time to do that. So I'm gonna go ahead and get started. So hi everybody again, if you didn't hear at the beginning, I am Sierra Royster. I'm the April Youth Program Coordinator. I wanted to thank you all for joining us today, especially if you've been on several of the youth stuff this week. This is gonna be the first of 5 sessions, so we're gonna get to know each other a little bit over the month of May. We're hoping that this training, you'll be able to, as a young person or somebody that's working with young people, be able to look at transition and understand, a young person can understand their rights and responsibilities more when they're ready to move into independent living, or if they're already living there and just wanting to freshen up some of those skills. So we're going to be doing that, covering all those different pieces throughout the next 5 weeks. This training is sponsored by the Research and Training Center on Independent Living at the University of Kansas. So we thank them so much for continuously and supporting you. This project and this idea of a training was brought by the April Youth Advocacy Committee, because what we have learned is in order to be an effective advocate, you have to know your rights and you have to be able to use those that knowledge, and there's ways to do that. And so that we've pulled up many trainings. This is just one of them on how to make ourselves better advocates. So today's call is a webinar platform. It's all run up the Zoom system. Hopefully you know that because you're on. You can follow along on the PowerPoint that was sent to you as an attachment, or you can also, sell your roommate. I get distracted. I'm like a squirrel. But you can follow along with the PowerPoint material that was sent out. But if you only follow along at home or on the phone, just to let you know, we will have some polls. You won't be able to join in at those unless you're online. So we do encourage you to jump online. You will not be able to join by webcam, at least for this week. So if you're looking forward to that and you got all pretty for today, I'm sorry. We'll try to if people are interested in joining the webcam later on.
Well, wait a minute, Sierra. That means I can still ask questions and stuff, right?
Yep, I'm going to get to that. Just the webcam's not on. But your ability to talk is...
Never mind.
Yeah, Steve is already practicing it for me.
Yes.
You can press *6 to mute and unmute your phone.
If you don't... No, the audio's at the bottom to mute you, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. I just can't see the PowerPoint and you guys at the same time. That's the issue.
Yep, if you give me 1 second, Stevie, I'll go ahead and cover all those bases so you can see all of that.
Okay, I'll calm down. Sorry.
So if you press *6, you'll be able to jump into the conversation, or press *9 if you don't want to jump in and you just want to raise your hand when there's a break or something. I'll know that you have a question or a comment, and I can unmute you at that point. There is a menu bar at the bottom of your screen. So if you scroll your mouse down at the bottom, you'll see options to the participants, options for a chat, and then you'll see options for mute and unmute. So there is where you can kind of control stuff as well, and then join to the chat as well. If you haven't pulled up the chat, I encourage you to do that. The pre-survey is there, so that would help us with those pieces. To know just a little bit more about you. And if you are going to join into the conversation, if you would just keep your background noise down. If you notice me muting you during the call, it's because there's some feedback somewhere, and so I may mute a few people. But if you have a question, again, you can jump in at that point. So enough of the housekeeping stuff. I want to introduce you to our two speakers for our guides for the next 5 weeks, which is a really long time. So firstly, you have Don Du, and he is the executive director at Disability Resource Center in, I'm going to mess it up, how do you say it? Oh, you're muted.
City.
What is it?
Sioux City.
Sioux City. Okay, see, I knew I would mess it up. In Iowa. Since 2012, he has been advocating for people with disabilities since 2005, and he is a new board member of April. He is a co-founder of Siouxland Pride Alliance, LGBT Resource Center in Northwest Iowa, a member of the Nebraska Silk, and a co-founder of Iowa's Disability Votes Count. A nonprofit to help people with disability be a part of the voting process and remove barriers to voting. His background is in criminal justice, DEO practices and ADA violations. One thing that he didn't put in there is he is well-versed in the Fair Housing Act and has worked with many consumers and IL workshops in his center teaching just this. So we're excited to have him here. We also have Dylan Richardson. He, I pulled in, we met at the April conference this past year. He was from Utah, is now a Washington resident, and he, in this time in Washington, or nope, in Utah, was spent at a Center for Independent Living there where he went into high schools, and one of the many things that he taught was Fair Housing Act. So we thank both of you all for part of this, and we're excited to get going. So what we can do now is whichever one's going to kick it off. Do you want to share your screen? Stevie, that will answer your question of where the PowerPoint is. So again, that's at the bottom.
Thank you.
So that was going to be me sharing my screen. So this is a fun lesson on how to do that. So here's share. Share my desktop. Share Safari. Yeah, let's do that.
Whoa.
There we go. And if you'll just put, Dylan, again, if you'll just put your presentation in PowerPoint mode. Perfect.
Perfect. Okay.
Awesome.
Well, welcome, everyone. This is the first week of 5 weeks talking about fair housing. Today is going to be kind of an introduction. We're going to talk about the Fair Housing Act, the laws that govern fair housing, some introductory definition kind of things, just to make sure everyone has a solid foundation and we're all on the same page when we're talking about this. So welcome, everyone, kind of enjoying the welcome. So we, in the chat box, we just want to see who is here today, who we have, just so both Don and I have an idea of what to talk about, how to approach the subject matter today. So in the chat box, if you can tell us your name, how old you are, and the city and state where you currently live, so that we can get to know everyone a little bit. And someone else is going to have to tell me what's going on in the chat box because I'm sharing.
Don't worry, I will cover it.
Okay.
And we do have, it works for Illinois Valley Center for Independent Living. Joanna Westgate, CFH provider.
Vic.
Remember that chat box is at the bottom of your screen. So if you just click on that thing that says chat, that will get you all the info.
I'm slow. Hold on.
Lisa Gabriel, St. Joseph. Oh, keeps moving on me. Y'all are going so fast. St. Joseph, Missouri, Merrill Youth Services and Transition Specialist. Conan Calhoun, 42 years old, Bloomington, Illinois, Disability Rights Advocate. Ashley, she's 29, and I live in Ottawa, Iowa. Our service area covers LaSalle, Euro, Marshall, Putnam, and Belle Spelton, 24, from Spokane, Washington, works for the Disability Action Center. They, them pronouns. Thanks, Mills. Stevie, Disability Resource Center, Wilmington, North Carolina, Youth Transition Coordinator. Okay. Looks like all that I've seen jump in. So thanks, everybody.
Oh, we just got Patrick and Teresa.
Yeah. Patrick, Youth Services Assistant from SIL Miami, covering Miami-Dade County. I'm 33 years old and from Miami, Florida. Teresa, I am 39, from the Center for People with Disabilities in Boulder, Colorado.
Fantastic. And thanks, everyone, for those folks who shared pronouns. Really appreciate that. I use they, them pronouns, by the way, just to make that clear. So now that we know who we have, let's talk a little bit more about housing, right? So talk about we want to know what your current housing situation is. So we've got a poll that Sierra is going to send out. And the question is, where do you live right now? Do you live with your parents or family? Do you live in your own apartment or house with no roommates? Do you live in an apartment or house with roommates? Do you live in a group living arrangement, like a group home or an adult family home? Do you live in a nursing facility or hospital? Or do you live in a shelter or temporary housing? So go ahead and answer that poll and we'll see what we're working with today.
And this is Don, and also welcome. The one thing I would say too is the people that are like independent living specialist or work at an independent living center. Since you do this for a variety of people, you might want to answer, like, who do you see the most need for housing from?
That's a great point, Don.
And it looks like we have just a few more people needing to participate. And then could you call it when you want, Dylan?
Okay, let's say 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
All right. I gave you another second, past Dylan.
So kind.
So it looks like 43% of the group are in an apartment or house with roommates.
Okay.
29% are with parents or family. And then and split 14% between two of them in own apartment or house / no roommates. Group living arrangement, group home. So those were both 14%. And then 0 are nursing facility or hospital, and 0 are shelter or temporary housing.
Okay. All right. Sounds great. So we've got kind of a lot of different people spread in different relatively independent living situations of varying degrees, from living in your own apartment without roommates to they may be living with some other people with disabilities, maybe living with a caregiver or something of that nature. So I think, and for those service providers who answered for their clients, if that's those are the people that you work with, I think that's pretty representative of a lot of the clients that we see, especially typically working with youth. It's a little more people living with parents and family. But yeah, I would say that this is a pretty typical distribution. All right, our next slide. So and we've got another poll. If you could tell us when you plan to move out into your own place. So if you plan to, if you already live on your own, you can tell us that. If you plan to move within the next 3 months, 6 months, the next year, 2 years from now, or 5 years from now. So we can figure out if looking into getting your own apartment, getting your own house is something that's right on the cusp, something you are going to be doing really soon, or if it's something you're planning for a little further in the future, or if it's something you've already done.
And I would add also too, like I work with a lot of 17, 18 year old people or people in their 20s that live with their family. If you want to put how long it usually takes for you to find housing, what's your plan? Do you have a plan with them and how long it usually takes? Housing is different in so many different areas, but it's always something that has to be part of a plan.
Very true.
And remember, we don't have everybody participating. Remember what Don said as well for the, and Dylan, I think, mentioned it as well, the consumers that you're serving too. Think about answering it in that perspective as well. And so I'll give it just another second. All right.
Okay. So seems pretty like the majority of people are looking for a little further in the future, either next year or in the next 2 years, with 13% in the next 6 months, and then 25% who already live on your own. So that's great. Fantastic. So for some of you, this might be information that you already know, some of these definitions and background information, but I think we'll also go into a little more detail, a little more of the history that I think is really important as far as being able to advocate for yourself and also teaching people that we work with how to advocate for their rights as well. So when we're talking about housing, right, we have this discussion because it really is one of our basic needs, one of the things that we have to have. So in terms of your housing, what is a basic need that you get from having a nice, comforting, warm place to live? If you could go in the chat room, in the chat box, and just type out, what is a basic need that is met by your access to having housing?
So again,
personally, for myself, I would say that having a place to seclude myself, that's something that is really important for me.
Right.
And a couple of people are answering now, but remember, if you scroll to the bottom of your screen, that toolbar pops up your options and that bubble down there with dots in it, that's your chat box. And so I'm not sure if Dylan and Don can see this, but it says we have shelter and another one from shelter as well.
Yeah, so the shelter is the obvious, right? You need a place to be able to rest and keep yourself safe from the elements and weather. But there's also some, if we look at this pyramid of Maslow's hierarchy of needs with physiological, our body's needs on the bottom, right? Things like warmth and food and rest, right? We definitely get those from our house. But we also, moving up the pyramid, right? But the rest of these are still affected by our housing and by having a house that is not just livable, habitable, but that is comfortable and where you feel comfortable spending your time, right? You can get belonging and love needs by having roommates or by living with someone that you care for, living with someone you're in a relationship with. You can have esteem needs by being able to, you can meet those needs by being able to create the space around you, make some place that makes you feel comfortable and accomplished. So when we talk about housing, it impacts us on multiple levels. It's more than just the basic need for shelter. And I think that's why it's such a pivotal conversation to talk about not just having access to housing, but how to do so in a way that is respectful of tenants and that respects everyone's right to human right to housing.
Absolutely.
So,
Ashley, really quick, Ashley put in there self-actualization, especially for my LGBTQ consumers, to be able to live their truth and not hide. And then
absolutely.
Yeah.
And that, I think that also correlates to people with disabilities as well. If you don't have a place that's accessible, if you can't use the bathroom safely, right, that's going to be a huge issue, right? And your ability to feel like a person is really impacted by how suitable your house is for you. So great point, Ashley. Really appreciate that.
And then Arius also put, also a place where I can be private.
Of course. Right. Yeah, that's definitely a big need, important thing to fulfill. So let's move on to some basic definitions just to make sure everyone knows what we're talking about when we use these words. And one thing that we just kind of toss around is housing. And that can include any living space, including a single family home, a duplex, apartment, condo, trailer, a yurt, a tent, right? Anywhere that someone is living, right, that's housing. And I think a lot of the time, our brain jumps to the idea of like house or apartment, but it's really important to remember that there are a lot of different living situations that people experience. And when we make assumptions, it can make people feel kind of vulnerable or ashamed if they don't have access to what is considered typical housing. So I think it's important. That's something that I really want to emphasize, is that housing is really a really wide umbrella. Rent refers to when you pay a person so that you can use something that they own, right? And when we're talking about housing, we're talking about renting an apartment, renting a house. This is a building that's owned by someone else, and you pay them a predetermined amount of money, something that you agree upon in advance to use that space for however, usually about a year for rent. A landlord is the person who owns that building or that apartment. This also could refer to other pieces of land, such as farms. But yeah, the landlord is the person who owns whatever thing that we're talking about and rents it out to other people. And the tenant is someone who lives on land or property that's owned by the landlord. So the tenant would rent from the landlord. The tenant pays rent to the landlord in order to use that space for however much time they have agreed upon. And fair housing, we use this term to refer to the laws that have been created to protect against housing discrimination. And this is based on the idea that housing is a human right, that the people shouldn't have to meet certain requirements in order to have access to housing, that everyone, just by their being human, deserves to have access to housing. And so that's why these laws, that's what predicated these laws, that's what was the that's what why they were created in the first place. And here I shall pass it over to my colleague Don to talk about the Fair Housing Act.
Yeah, thank you, Dylan. So the U.S. Fair Housing Act was passed in 1968, but for so many people, it seems kind of murky, and people don't know what that is. This law made it illegal to refuse to sell or rent a house or apartment to someone based on who they were as a person. And it drilled down deeper than that. And so it went to different protected classes. And a protected class is a group of people qualified for special protection under the law. And there's seven protected classes under the Fair Housing Act. You cannot be denied housing because of a protected class. The first one is you can't be denied because of your race. And you can't be denied because of the color of your skin. Another protected class is you cannot be denied housing because of your religion. You cannot be denied housing because of the country you were born in. That's a protected class. The Fair Housing Act covers your biological sex. You cannot be denied housing because of your biological sex. And it also, of course, then protects, so you cannot be denied housing because of your disability. The one thing a lot of people don't know is the Fair Housing Act covers, so you cannot be denied because of the family members that you live with. So.
Okay, so let's pause for questions now that we've sort of talked about those protected classes. Those classes that we talked about, that's what's covered under federal law. So all of the states in the United States, it's illegal to refuse to provide someone housing based on their membership in one of those protected classes. However, most of the states have their own individual Fair Housing Acts that refer just to those states. So that are usually a little more detailed. And like when we mentioned federally, it's illegal to discriminate, to not provide someone housing based on their biological sex, based on the sex they were assigned when they were born. But federally, it is not illegal to discriminate against someone based on their gender identity. There is no federal law protecting transgender people to have access to housing. Many states have passed laws to protect transgender people and their access to housing, but federally, that's not something that currently exists.
Although, under President Obama, the HUD, the Department of HUD had released guidelines protecting people who were LGBT or had any other type of reason to believe that they might be discriminated because of sexual orientation or gender identity. So those things have kind of been rolled back, and you don't really see that now, but that is where then you have to see what your state has. In Iowa, any city over 25,000 people has a human rights commission, and so then we are able to check out and investigate discrimination. Not all states have that, but it's helpful if a state does have that.
A question that came in. It said, what about income requirements? And Stevie, maybe.
Yeah, so this is a very good, we're going to have an entire, our fifth session is going to be talking about housing affordability, because that's a huge issue, is finding places that that are affordable with minimum wage and low income people. So we're going to have an entire session dedicated to that. But if you have a more specific question, perhaps we could address that, Stevie.
Right.
And just a reminder to everybody also, you can mute and unmute from home. Everybody has the ability to do that. If you're on the phone, you can press *6. If you're on the webinar, you can go to the bottom of your screen and the microphone is all the way at the left and you can press that to unmute.
Because when I think of income requirements, there are a lot of, we're going to talk about public housing at the end of this presentation. And well, we'll talk about some of the income requirements for those units when we get there.
And it doesn't look like any other questions have come
in. Okay, so we can move on. Oh my goodness. So the Fair Housing Act, it lays out those protected classes, those groups of people who are protected in housing, but it also talks about each individual step of the housing process that where they hope to prevent discrimination. And by discrimination, we're talking about unfair treatment of different categories of people, treating people differently based on their membership in those protected classes. And before we go on, I did see that Arias just posted a question. Going through a housing issue and have gone through all the systems agencies I could, and no one out of state will touch it. What do I do? Oh, that's a tough question, Arias, and I will connect with you after this because I think that's only going to be a long conversation. Yes, each of the steps where it's illegal to discriminate. So it's illegal to discriminate in the terms, conditions, or privileges of a sale or a rental. So if you're renting a property, you can't say, well, from these people, the security deposit's $400, but you use a wheelchair, so you might dent up the apartment, you might add some scuffs on the walls, and I'm going to have to pay for that, so your security deposit's higher. That's illegal because you're discriminating against someone based on their membership in a protected class, being disabled. So you cannot, all of the conditions of a rental, the way that you interact with every person who comes to look at your properties has to be the same. In addition, it's illegal to advertise a preference of who rents your property. That again refers only specifically to those protected classes. Unfortunately, there are still times when we're going to talk about some exemptions about private housing. Like if I'm renting out a room in my house, I can do pretty much whatever I want because that's my domicile. And if I live in that house, then I get to set the rules. But if I'm renting out a house where I don't live, you cannot set a preference if you rent your property. It has to be accessible to anyone who is looking and can afford it.
And just to let everybody know, there was an image on the screen for an ad in the newspaper that says apartment for rent, and it describes the apartment, large three-bedroom, great neighborhood, two-bath, new appliances, hardwood floors, washer and dryer, dishwasher, AC, private parking, $1,200 a month, utilities. And the bottom of that, in bold letters, no kids, no blacks, no Latinos. So I think that's a perfect visual example of that. Illegal activity.
Yeah, so that would be illegal. You couldn't do that anywhere in the United States. What about preference to students? That's a great question.
A
lot of places will refuse to rent to students, and because being a student is not a protected class under the Fair Housing Act, that is unfortunately legal.
So, Dylan, what if that newspaper ad didn't have the no kids, no blacks, no Latinos, but just said no dogs? What if you had a service animal?
Ooh, that's a good question. And we're going to talk about service animals during our accommodation presentation. But if the ad says no dogs, a service animal is not a pet. So you could pretty much disregard that if you see that in an ad. Your dog is exempt from any landlord preference about pets in a unit because they're not a pet. They're working.
I just wanted to throw that out. Or an emotional support animal is what Stevie said. So.
Yeah. As long as you have a letter, some sort of certification from a licensed professional. So it has to be a therapist, a counselor, a doctor, someone saying that this is medically necessary for you to have this emotional support animal, then yes, that also would counteract any landlord wishes about animals in the unit. Great questions. So it's illegal to coerce, threaten, intimidate, or interfere with a person's enjoyment or use of their housing rights. So if at any point you notice that a landlord has been discriminatory, if you notice that they're treating you differently based on your membership in those protected classes, and you try to seek retribution for that, you alert the housing authority, you try to get someone involved, the landlord is not legally able to interfere with your use of, I'm not explaining this very well. So I think this typically refers to if you are already living in an apartment and you maybe are having a dispute with your landlord and you go to seek mediation for it, you have another organization get involved, your landlord cannot raise your rent, they can't turn your electricity off, they can't bully you into moving out because that would be illegal. That's treating you differently than other tenants. Yes, and again, related to that, it's legal to retaliate against a person for using their fair housing rights. You can't evict someone because they lodged a complaint against you as a landlord. The fair housing rights exist, and that's what the law is, and the benefit tends to go towards the tenant in that. So,
this is Sierra. I have a question actually about that. So, in order to say that somebody can't do that, wouldn't you have to prove you were being retaliated against, or?
Yes, there would have to be a direct connection, and you would have to prove that it was different from the way that they treated other residents.
Okay. And
Sierra, this is Don. Usually with retaliation, there would have been a complaint filed first, and then they would have be retaliating for that complaint that is filed.
Okay.
And so that would be retaliation on that.
Got it.
Okay. And like we mentioned, there are some exemptions to the Fair Housing Act. So everything that we have said doesn't apply if the owner of the house lives there with fewer than three other families. So if I own a house and I rent two of my rooms out to other people, the Fair Housing Act doesn't apply and I can set any rules or restrictions that I want. The same goes for if someone's selling a house without the use of a real estate agent, if it's just a private sale and transaction between two individuals, again, the Fair Housing Act does not apply and anything goes. And in addition to that, any housing that's operated by an organization or a private club is able to limit the occupancy of that housing to its members. So what first comes to my mind is a fraternity, right? It's totally legal for a fraternity to say, you can't live in this house because you're not a member of this group. We own this house. Same thing goes for religiously owned properties, right? They don't rent it out publicly. It's only available to people who are a member of that organization. And do you have any other exemptions to add, Dom?
No, that's good.
So we will move on.
So, a lease is, of course, the contract that explains your agreement with the landlord. And the lease is going to tell you how to pay your rent, how much your rent costs, the rules for living in your apartment or house, the quiet hours, rules for guests, where to dispose of garbage, who to call in an emergency, when your lease ends, and when you need to leave the apartment or house. That's very important because you need to follow what the lease says.
So, and just really quick for anybody that's new to that, Where would somebody get their?
I'm sorry, you cut out. Where would somebody...
Oh, sorry. Where would somebody find their lease? Like, how would they get it?
So, if they don't have a copy of their lease, then, the apartment manager should have it.
Okay.
Yeah, typically the lease is something that you sign before you move into the apartment. And it's really important that before you sign it, you've read it so that you know all of this information, right? So you should have a copy of your lease. You should have access to all of that information before you sign anything, because you want to make sure you've gone through it. You understand exactly what it says before you agree to it, because signing that lease is an agreement saying I'm going to do everything it says on this paper.
Right. It's a contract that you don't want to break, because that can cost thousands of dollars. They will take you to court if you don't. Well, yeah, here's broken lease. When you sign your lease, you're agreeing to everything it says. If you have any questions or issues, solve them before you sign. Whether it's talking about whether you can put grab bars in the bathroom, if there's already spots from cigarettes on the carpet, take pictures of that, but show that also to the landlord, because once you've signed the lease, it's there, and it can be a nightmare to get out of. And was it Arius that had a question?
Yep. Arius says, is there a certain number of pages a lease should have?
No. I've seen 1-page leases, and I've seen 10 and 20-page leases.
Yeah, really the length just means the longer it gets, it means the more rules are being added. So if it's longer, just make sure that you can look through and you still agree to everything it says. Because longer doesn't necessarily mean worse. It could just mean that that's where they lay out all the information. If you have any questions, you won't have to ask someone. You can just refer to your lease because all of the information is there. So there's no real length requirement.
And there are some real estate attorneys that will look at leases for you for free. So if you happen to know one, it's always good to do that.
This is Sierra again. So you're more so in a lease, not looking for the pages. It sounds like you're looking for the content. Now, can you get a copy of your lease prior to the time you have to sit down and sign it? So you, if you wanted a day or a week or so for the lawyer to review.
Absolutely.
Right. Yes, you can. Okay.
Yeah. And if a landlord is trying to pressure you into signing a lease without giving you adequate time, I would even be wary.
Yeah, I wouldn't do it.
So this is here. Sorry, I had another question. A lot of times that I've worked with public housing, especially, they say you have 3 days to decide if you want this house or not, or this apartment. And so within those 3 days, that's the only time that you would get at that point, correct? To look over your lease? Is that what you found?
Yeah. Public housing... depends on the public housing. I'm going to say that they're usually pretty good with letting you, have a copy, have somebody look through it. It's having those relationships with your public housing people. So.
Yes, and Arius, I'm not sure a specific addendum you'd look over more carefully before you sign it. I think really my recommendation is look over the whole thing. I know it's long, I know it's boring, I know it's hard to understand. Get someone to help sift through it if you need to, because it's really, really important that you know what it says.
Yeah.
Now, Don, this is, you mentioned a lawyer perhaps that could do that. Would that be, and I know this is very location specific, state specific, but do you think that would be something that legal aid lawyers would be willing to do at times, or you're talking about a whole different?
Legal aid usually won't, okay. At least here they won't, but you can always try. They have sent us to other attorneys to have them look at the leases. So,
okay. It sounds like you could at least reach out to legal aid to ask that question.
Right, right. Okay.
Thank you.
And Stevie, we're going to talk about accommodation in a little bit. We'll get there.
I'll stop asking questions, Stevie.
So, security deposit. An initial sum of money you give to your landlord to ensure the rest of the rent will be paid. Usually it is at least the same amount as the first month's rent. Sometimes it's more, but at least the first month's rent is what I see. Is that right with you, Dylan?
Yes, typically at least that much and often more. And like what Don was saying earlier about documenting any damage to the apartment when you move in, I think is really important. What I usually recommend is if you have a smartphone or a camera, do a video walkthrough. Record all of the walls, the floors, make sure you get anything documented and so that you can say, hey, this was here before I moved in. Because otherwise, the landlord will take that security deposit money to fix the problem, which absolutely. If you didn't cause the problem, you shouldn't have to pay for it. And that's the idea of a security deposit. If you take care of the apartment while you live there, then you'll get that money back in return. Accommodation.
So we hear about accommodation a lot, but with a house or apartment, you know, it really varies, but it's a change or an adjustment that gives a person with a disability equal access to use and enjoy their living space. The picture on the screen shows a ramp going up to a front door of a house, but it could be other items such as grab bars in the bathroom, gosh, now I'm like blank, but the thing is, even if the landlord lets you put an accommodation in, it usually is at your own cost, and you can have to, they will most likely make you take those out when you leave. Why? I don't know, because it only enhances their property, but that is part of the law. But I don't know why they would do that. I mean, it doesn't necessarily mean that they would, but maybe somebody does not want a wooden ramp going up to the front door. But say you put grab bars in the bathroom and make it safer for everybody, then it is safer for everyone. Why take that out of the wall? So.
Plus, you could damage the wall by taking it out and not realizing it.
Well, absolutely. I mean, that's...
It. And not meaning to.
So, eviction, that's when a tenant is forced to leave their rental property. And that can be done several ways. Usually, like by the time I see somebody, they've gotten their... It's like a 3-day notice to quit. And they will be going through an eviction process. 3 days doesn't mean 3 days. They still have to go through the whole process. And it's usually either because they haven't paid the rent for several months or a variety of things, you know, who knows?
And we'll be going more in depth into eviction, what can result in eviction, and the eviction process, I believe, in the 4th training.
Right. Yeah.
Can I back up for just a second, guys?
Yeah, what's up?
I just want to let you know, I kind of posted something in the chat box, but I know I've lived in multiple apartments, and a lot of times they'll give you a checklist of checking certain areas for, you know, previous tenants and what might be, you know, might be considered damage. You just check that off. And then if it's, you know, anything major, you might take a picture of it and just add it to it. But they usually give you about a week to turn that in.
It depends upon the management, especially a lot of larger complexes will have those check-in sheets. But again, I always recommend having your own evidence in addition to that, because sometimes forms get lost. And, you know, I tend to stay on the side of not trusting landlords. So
that's why I was going to suggest to keep a copy of your own to put with your lease so that you know what you turned in.
Yeah, it's a good idea.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Thank you, Stevie, for capturing that. One other comment to just go back a few slides. Arias mentioned we were talking about lawyers to potentially look over that lease. Could you go to the University College of Law? Do you think that would be a suitable place?
If you find a friendly professor with lots of time.
Yeah. So, Arias, the one thing I would say about going to a university is usually they'll tell you this is not legal advice and we cannot be counted as legal advice. So if something was wrong with the lease or something, you wanted to hold somebody accountable to, you told me this, there is no accountability to a university because they have not passed the bar at that point. And even if they're professor, that's not their actual position. Right. So just knowing what you're using it for. But I wanted to capture that comment. So thank you.
Thanks,
Siri.
Oh, this is me. Okay, so now we're going to talk about the public housing and housing authorities. And that's a term that I think it's used a lot and no one ever really tells you what it means. So a housing authority is a government organization. It's an organization that's funded by the state or city or county government that provides free or low-cost housing to qualified individuals, people who make less than a certain amount of money per month. And whatever that amount of money is different based on what the location that you're in. If on the screen there, you can see the logos for 7 different housing authorities from Columbus, Ohio, Atlanta, New York, Baltimore City. The rent price is going to be usually based on what's called the fair market rent in that area is, which is the average rent price for a 1-bedroom or 2-bedroom apartment. And you can find those on the Department of Housing and Urban Development or HUD website. They've got the whole database where you can click and search for your city or your county, and it'll tell you what the fair market rent for that location is. And so public housing is any housing that's owned by that housing authority, and typically each unit is going to have different requirements for who is allowed to live there. Some of them are only for people with disabilities. Some of them are 55 plus for older individuals. Most of them have income requirements where you can't make over a certain amount of money, and some of them are what we call subsidized. Which means these are housing units that sometimes they're owned by a private company, sometimes they're owned by housing authorities, where your total rent is equal to 30% of your income. So there is no set rental price. The rent is based on what your income is. So if you make $1,000 a month, then your rent would be $300, and that's what you would pay. The rest of that rent would be paid by another. There's lots of different ways that subsidized housing works. Sometimes the private company who owns the housing unit is grant funded. Sometimes they have tax credits. Some subsidized units are, what was I going to say? I can't remember. I lost my train of thought. Yes, 30% of your income. That's the rule for the subsidized housing. And I really was going to say something that I felt was important and I can't remember. So that's a shame. But I believe this brings us to the end of our PowerPoint, the end of our presentation for today. So I would love to hear what questions you all have about the stuff that we've covered. I know this is a very, very basic just introduction. We're going to go much more in depth on a lot of these topics across the next 4 weeks.
Right.
So really quick, just to let everybody know, as Dylan just stated, so this is just like the surface. What I think Dylan and Don are both hoping is that you'll walk away with these terms and the knowledge behind what these terms mean, because these are the things that you're going to need to know when listening to the rest of the sessions. Right, right. So this way we're all on the same playing field and can understand the lingo. So if you have a question, go ahead, Dylan.
And also for the people who are watching who are professionals who work in the field, who work with people who are looking for housing, I think it's really important because we use these terms a lot and maybe we have an idea of what they mean, but I think having words to actually define them, to be able to explain them to the people that we're working with is really important and helps to empower our clients. Will you cover housing vouchers? Yes. Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Section 8, that's the kind of subsidized housing where it's a federal program. There's incredibly long wait list if the wait lists are even open in most areas. But once you get qualified for Section 8, it's kind of like the housing golden ticket, right? You have you will have to pay 30% of your income towards your rent. And as long as you have your annual renewal and you submit your social security information to them, you're a good tenant, you don't have any complaints, then you can keep that Section 8 voucher pretty much forever. So,
and you can go anywhere with it after you've been there for a year. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah. So if you have lived in an apartment for a year, you've completed your lease, you have an amicable, a friendly relationship with your landlord, you aren't being evicted, then you can take that Section 8 voucher and it can transfer to any housing authority across the country.
Yeah, it travels with the person, not necessarily with, it just, with the person with whoever accepts the Section 8 voucher, correct?
Yes.
Yes.
And unfortunately, Section 8 is hard to come by nowadays. A lot of people who are on Section 8 qualified a decade ago, and it's getting slower and slower, the number of people who are getting qualified. So unfortunately, as great of a program as it is, it's kind of losing steam.
True.
I just had a person, I guess there's an online site for people who are looking across the country for Section 8. And so he gets alerts to the places that he wants to live. And he just got an alert for a new Section 8 apartment, never been lived in Crested Butte, Colorado. And they accepted him and he's moving. So dreams come true for people, you know. It was kind of nice.
Yeah, and Arias has said some states you can only apply if the list is open. And unfortunately, because so many people have already signed up on the wait list, you're correct. A lot of states or counties will shut down the wait list for periods of time to try to sift through and get the number down before they reopen it.
Right, right.
Dylan, quick question. Sorry, Sierra.
You're good.
Okay. I don't know what the term is, and I could be totally off base, but isn't there a different voucher besides Section 8 that is geared towards the disabled and elderly, and I cannot remember what it's called?
There are some vouchers, some Medicaid vouchers, depending, they're called different things based on where they are. In Washington, I think they're called like needy elderly and disabled or something like that. It's kind of strange.
Yeah.
A lot of the time, those, there are really specific requirements for who qualifies for those. Like a lot of the time you have to have lived in an institution like a nursing home or a hospital for 30 or 60 days before you would qualify for that voucher. But if that's true, if for some reason, maybe you had a surgery and you were recovering for a couple of months, maybe you had a spinal cord injury and you were living in a nursing home for a year and you lost your apartment, those vouchers do exist to help that transition back into independent housing. And they will take the money that would pay for the facility and will pay for the apartment. But it's kind of a difficult process, and there's a lot of hoops to jump through.
Like money follows a person.
Right.
Yes.
Okay. Got it. Thank you.
Great questions. Any other questions?
This was Sierra. I just had a quick question about the last three slides. So you talked about the housing authority, and then you said housing authority owns the housing units, which make that a public housing. And then you talked about subsidized housing.
Yes. So not all public housing is subsidized, and not all subsidized housing is public. And so these are terms that are kind of interrelated, and a lot of times overlap, but don't always. And I know it's incredibly confusing.
Sierra, let me give you a heads up. In our area, we have what's called a street sheet, which also explains kind of what different housing and what their qualifications are. I don't know if every area has that. I do know that we have that in the Wilmington area, but I don't know if that's helpful to anybody.
Perfect.
And I wrote down a couple of notes about protected classes at the beginning of the presentation, some groups of people that it's often debated about whether or not this it's a protected class, whether you can discriminate against these people in housing. And one of them is medical cannabis users. And that's because cannabis is currently prohibited under federal law, regardless of the state law, regardless of if it's legal where you live. It's completely legal for a landlord to restrict cannabis use, even if it's been prescribed by a doctor in their properties, because they default to the federal law over the state law. And we talked about a little bit, we talked about families, but we didn't talk about source of income. In some states, Medicaid recipients or Social Security recipients are a protected class. So if I'm using Social Security to pay my rent, it's illegal to say, no, I don't know if you're going to have enough money. I don't trust that you'll pay the rent on time. I'm going to find someone with a job. That's illegal in some states, but not all states.
But in the same sense, anybody could get laid off at any time. So how it could go both ways, you know, I don't know.
That's true. And Arius, I see you've had a comment, technically only if you smoke it. I think that might be a joke. It's partially, right, most housing will have rules against smoking. But it's possible for a landlord to have a rule saying that you can't have any sort of cannabis product in the house at all. And of course, unless they come by and search your stuff, they're not really going to know, but that can be included in the lease, and it's important to be aware of if it is.
Okay, this is really great, but I want to be respectful of everybody's time, and we are coming to the top of our hour. I hope that this gave you so much knowledge on just the basics, and know that deep as we keep moving forward.
What happened? There we go.
I did want to go ahead and just remind everybody that we are going to be meeting every Thursday in May. So that puts it here. It will load. There we go. Puts us at May 9th as our next session, when we're going to be talking about who's who, the tenant-landlord relationship. As we know, those can be kind of stressful, as even Dylan mentioned, and sometimes people have that trust issue with them because they've been burned before. So we're going to be talking about how to make sure you have a healthy relationship there, and if not, what do you do and what are your rights with that? And then just to mark your calendar, May 16th, May 23rd, and May 30th, because I know there was a lot of what about accommodations and income and those kind of things. They will come, and we would love to answer the question right on the time that you ask, but some of them are just such an in-depth question that it takes more time than that, so we want to make sure we answer it thoroughly. So make sure you mark your calendar. Just as a reminder, it is 3 to 4 Eastern time, 2 o'clock Central, 1 o'clock Mountain, 12 o'clock Pacific. Whew, that's always hard for me off the top of my head. So just make sure that you have those noted in your calendar as well as the time for those. And I will be resending out the link every week, so you can just use that. Please know that these have been recorded. We do have a transcript. And those will all be sent at the end, but if you for some reason are needing it before then, please let me know and I can send that to you. before, and it all will be archived on our website at the end of the series, so you'll be able to go back and reference it there. And just as a note, if you're somehow got this link and information to get on this website and you have not registered, please make sure you do that. One of the things that will be coming out with this are some handout pieces, so actually things I will send in the mail that are paper, but just as good resources, and there will also be some emails that go out for future resources as well. So make sure I have that information for you so you can continue to get that. So that's what I got for everybody. Thank you all for joining. We're going to be meeting again next Thursday. So Dylan and Don, thanks for walking us through these first terms and the basic knowledge, and we're excited.
Absolutely. And I just want to address, there was one question that just got posted. So they have someone who has a consumer who wants to join. Absolutely. You don't have to be a professional to join. This is open to anybody.
Yeah, this is encouraged. Invite your consumers and have a group of consumers if y'all all want to discuss it, and have them join from your center. That's definitely welcomed. Friends, family, other youth, this is open to the public. So please have everybody join.
Sierra, one quick question. What website will this be archived on? The April site?
On the April website, yep.
Okay, just want to make sure.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks.
All right. Well, I think that's it then. Everybody have a great afternoon or morning, depending on where you're at.
You too. Thanks, guys. Okay.
Thanks.
Ooh, let me look out. How do you log out?